you know? If you think
they just conducted a whole like entire world war on one city.
Oh yeah. And
they got to try out all their lethal toys. Every up and coming fighter jet got to do a mission of his own. Like it's just a profession for them.
Absolutely.
And that's how Americans fight. They fight cowardly from the sky.
They do. And I thought to myself, you know, this is fucked up. This is fucked up. Eventually, we got pulled off the front line. So we didn't enter the city at that point. IFB was retracted. We got pulled from the front. So we went to the rear. And while we were, you know, we were still on the front, but we were just not on the front line. We were just behind the front line, basically second barrier. And it was there I got injured. I fell off a roof at nighttime. And I injured my leg. And my knees, and I was in a cast. So that was all of my frontline experience, was basically phase 4 into phase 5. But I never fought in the city itself. I fought all the way to the city. And then I was injured. I went to the rear. And it was while I was in the rear that I started to become, you know, I started to question a lot more about the Syrian, quote-unquote, civil war, about what was going on, about the U.S. role there. And, you know, to me, I started to ask, you know, now that I had a lot more time, I eventually returned and spent the remainder of the conflict in Serekanya, Reis al-Ain, which is on the border. It's currently occupied by, you know, Turkish-backed FSA and Turkey itself proper, really. But it's on the border. It's on the Turkish border in northeast Syria. And it was while I was there, I met Armenians. I met local Arabs, Turkomans, and I realized that actually a lot of them didn't mind Bashar al-Assad. They didn't mind the Syrian Arab army. In fact, they wanted Assad to retake this part of Syria altogether. And I started to have my doubts and my
questions. It's because of they represent the Syrian state. Like they wanted the state to return.
Correct.
This is the anarchist, right? This is the anarchist line. Oh, states are bad, like vertical, blah, 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 right? Like, but like when in absence of a state, if you have ISIS showing up, like you choose the state every time. Absolutely. And that's the part of the story anarchists leave out.
And this is the part that I, because I did a lot of interviews after, and now I'm totally, forget about it. I am a persona non grata in the anarchist community, but also fuck them. I mean, they're horrible.
Anarchist community have long since shown themselves to be willing participants in U.S. empire.
I call them anarcho-imperialists. Anarcho-imperialists,
they send their sons and they send their little fail sons, one of whom is a prominent podcaster now, and they just get to like make careers off of it. And it's just a big joke. And you circulate this picture of the guy holding a puppy, but like he's an occupier, like he's a foreign fighter. In a foreign country, a white guy working in tandem with the U.S. military to destroy a West Asian country.
Well, you also
like,
had
that's the reality, and I guess in some ways, like I mean, that's what you saw, what you were doing that night too. You were like, look at the people I'm working with.
Absolutely, but you know what? There were very few of us who came to this realization. Very few of us, and I have to credit it with my background. But pre-U.S. military, I mean, talking about like my family background, a strong anti-imperialist position. Because, you know, I had been called a tanky way before. It's now popularized. I could be called a tanky way before that. You know, I had a deep love and affection for, you know, actually existing socialism. And, you know, and of course, then I hated myself. I said, oh, my God, how could you have liked this stuff? Oh, my God, the state and authority. And, oh, my God, reading Hannah Arendt, totalitarianism, you know. Later did I realize that Hannah Arendt's a racist and herself, you know.
Crazy, insane racist, imperialist. Oh,
and of course, and yeah. Totally lover of the American Revolution,
collaborator with other Nazis.
Absolutely. Let's not talk about Heidegger now. So I wanted, like, I said to myself, this is not something I support. When I returned, so I left Syria in late August, early September 2017. So
you were there for 8 months, 9 months in
nine
total
months,
fighting.
Nine months in total.
You got injured. You got injured what day?
I got injured in July 2017.
So those whole 8 months, January to July.
Yep.
Or six.
Well, July, I was still there. I was still there, even while I was injured. Right. I was still there. I was treated at a Syrian hospital, and I spent the remainder of my time just recovering in.
And everyone's speaking in English to you?
Well, no, Kurdish, Turkish, and then of course English. You know, back and forth in the international group, because there were a lot of people. There were people from the U.S., people from the U.K., French, you know, German, a lot of Germans. Germans are number one pipeline.
I have a question. That's interesting. Was there a lot of talk of the Spanish Civil War?
Oh my God, big time. This was the Spanish Civil War round two.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Except you were on the side. Of course. Yeah. That's so funny. That's so insane. Because that's part of the story of the so-called Shia militias, right? Like the Hashd al-Sha'bi or the PMU in Iraq or the Iranian organized forces. And like that's something that's interesting to me in situating in the history of anti-fascism, right? Because there were two distinctly sides of this sort of, if you can call Daesh a fascist fighting force, which it was, then people who fought against it were doing Antifa, right? Like that stands to reason. However, if the people doing the Antifa are fighting in alliance with an imperialist force, then you have to ask yourself, like, what is the question? Now, the irony for me is that a lot of anarchists, a lot of Rojava types will point to me and say something like, oh, you're a tanky, you're an Assadist. And it's like, wait, so if I'm an Assadist, that makes you an imperialist American bootlicker, right? Like, which one is worse? Like, which one is worse? And so that's where the cognitive dissonance come in, that the enemy of their enemy does not reflect them. That the fact that the YPG, the rebranded as the SDF, can make an ally out of the Americans, then that is the situation of the enemy of my enemy is a friend, and that's just like a temporary alliance and contradictions, blah blah blah, like all the excuses you can make. But in reality, the reality is that you're waging a campaign of balkanization, which in the end comes down to the country's destruction. In the name of saving it from ISIS. I mean, that's the American logic. Destroy Raqqa so ISIS can't get it. And then send in your allies to clean it up and then make some Netflix documentaries about it.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest things for me was that, now mind you, we're fighting Raqqa from the north, right? We're advancing to Raqqa in the north. In the south is the Syrian Arab Army and all of its groups, Syrian Resistance, SSNP, all these different Shia militias. Then you have Hezbollah. Then you have General Soleimani coming from the south with the Russian air power. So I'm thinking to myself, this is really something. In the north, you have the U.S. coalition, basically NATO forces, with disparate communist, socialist, anarchist groups, the Kurds, all these other tribal groups coming from the north. The south, you have this opposite force that are, and we're all fighting Daesh, which is also supported by U.S. coalition.
That's the difference. Like, who is supporting Daesh and who's supporting this war? Like, who's helping to orchestrate this war?
Absolutely,
and not just responding to it.
Absolutely, and when I was in the rear, I started talking to a lot of older comrades. Comrades who had fought in Lebanon. Comrades who had fought in Nagorno-Karabakh, comrades who had fought in Turkey, comrades who had been in the PKK for a long time.
And these are all Kurdish, mind you, right? These are all Kurds or no?
Kurdish, like Kurdish, Turkish, Armenian, and some Arabs. Because there were also Arabs in the PKK as well, with a strong hatred of Turkey, you know, this, that, you know. And this was also communists as well. Communists not in the PKK, but in other communist groups as well. Maoists or Hodges, they were all there. And I started to realize that they had done mental gymnastics to get around the fact that for most of their lives, some of them were in their 70s, by the way. Some of them were in their 70s. I had the honor and the pleasure to be trained by Orhan Yoldash or Orhan Bakrjayan, Nubarozanian. He was a guerrilla fighter. He went to Lebanon in the 70s and fought with the PFLP in the 80s, was a member of Asala, went and fought in Nagorno-Karabakh, did missions in Europe to assassinate prominent Turkish officials, and then ended up in the Turkish Communist Party, Marxist-Leninist. He was a Maoist all along. He fought in the guerrilla war in Turkey, then in Iraq, and now he was the commander of the Maoist group in northeast Syria, which I was based at. I'll never find a more classic image of the guerrilla. I mean, a man in his 70s, has a family in Armenia, dedicated to the guerrilla struggle, you know, always was reading, exercising, washing dishes, you know, not like this kind of orientalist fantasy of a commander with a big pistol just hanging out. No, the definition of a commander in the East, always working hard, always working for the people, always giving bread, sugar, eggs to all the neighboring villagers who loved him, by the way, loved him. And it was my relationship with him that really altered my perspectives, finally to realize what was going on. But also he died while I was there. He was martyred while I was there, which was an absolute tragedy. But he himself was saying that, look, he eventually opened my eyes, and then eventually I went beyond him because he didn't go the step further. So he would say, look, the Americans are the enemy. The Americans and the coalition are the enemies, but let's get as much as we can out of them because we need to train as many people as we can to fight them eventually. Classic, like, sort of Maoist people's war. Like, we need to ally with... And this, of course, he looked to history and he said, well, Mao, during the occupation by the Japanese, Mao had alliances with, you know, the Chinese Communist Party had alliances with the nationalists. They also fought the nationalists, but they also had, you know, connections with the Americans that were helping to supply stuff, and also they were enemies, blah, blah, blah. So he was saying, now is the point for getting as much as we can, and then we can use it all against them. But of course, I told him, this isn't the 1940s, nor is it the 1960s. We have drones above us. This is not, people's war no longer works in the classic sense. It has to be, it's a lot different now. So it can't be, you know, people, you know, I love the Maoists online because they're all like, you know, people's war, Peru. Good, go to the mountains. You don't even, the guy can be in Nevada or Utah on a computer with a joystick. The drone just has to find a heat signature and they're going to take you out. That's what's happening right now in the mountains where the PKK and all these other guerrilla groups are.
I mean, that's what happened in Artsakh.
Of course, right. Of course. So yeah. you can't fight like that anymore. Fighting now has to evolve. And this is asymmetric warfare, you know, technology, all this kind of stuff. Fighting has to be different now. And that's just a reality. His perspective was the Americans are the enemy, but let's use them for as much as we can. And then after we can go against them. And he actually was very much more supportive of the Assad government because, of course, he had been in Lebanon. He knew which side Hafez al-Assad was on. And I don't know deeply about his history because it's still shrouded in mystery, but chances are easily they must have had connections with the SAA and, you know, all this different... There was a lot of stuff going on at that time in the war in Lebanon and then after with Lebanon, Syria, and what was going on in the wider region against Turkey. So he had the idea that, okay, let's use the Americans and get as much as we can. I eventually said, well, no, we shouldn't be allied with the Americans at all. We should be opposed to the Americans being here because the Americans at that time were building bases in the Northeast. He said, okay, the Americans can come and just do air power. But he sadly, you know, was martyred. The Americans at that time were building bases, permanent bases, not one or two, 8, 9, 10. So I thought to myself, this is a problem. This is not just helping defeat Daesh. This is permanent occupation and Balkanization, right? So all the mental gymnastics that we did at the time to say, oh, well, the American and coalition are helping us in our fight against this fascist force. And, you know, this is the second. Wait a minute. That doesn't mean permanent military bases. Now it was permanent military bases. And you could see the buildup. You could see the troop transports. You could see this. We saw American troops. We saw all of the, they had the various airfields. So I thought to myself, this is getting a little bit crazy over here. This is not what I thought. This is basically a Vichy government now. You know, the SDF and the PYD are now basically, you know, puppets of the coalition here. So it was while I was there in August where I started to get really cold feet about the whole situation and started to have a lot of dialogue. But the higher ups didn't want to acknowledge that. And of course, they would tell us, for example, well, the Americans are giving us these basically these shoulder-fired rockets that had heat signature, all this kind of stuff, you know, fancy technology that could destroy Daesh, but they were taking them into Turkey and destroying Turkish tanks. So they said,
"Can't do that."
Oh yeah. So, well, the Americans were still supplying them, and the Kurds said, "Let's get as many as we can because we need them to destroy these tanks and these armored vehicles and all this stuff." So that's what they were doing. So
because you can sell them more. You can sell them more.
Of course. So eventually I got cold feet. We eventually went back over the border. And oh, mind you, let me tell you one thing. Another interesting aside that I'm currently researching and working on. In the north, in the northeast of Syria, in a city that the Kurds called Derik, I think it's Al-Malakiyah in Arabic. And in this city, outside of the city, the Kurds had taken over a facility. And we went to go visit this facility because it was a major YPG point for leadership. Well, the sign was very interesting because I was the only one who could identify the sign because it was in Chinese. The sign was Sinopec, the largest Chinese state-owned oil and gas company. And I was so fascinated. I said, Sinopec has a facility here? The Hevals there had no clue. And it wasn't until I researched it more that before the Syrian civil war started, China was given the exclusive rights to develop the oil in the northeast with a joint venture with a few other companies. But China had the majority share of it. So they were supposed to develop the oil in what's currently Deir ez-Zor, and then the northeast in the area around Derik. And I thought to myself, China's also in the equation here, because the oil there is not a lot. It's not a huge quantity like you can imagine Venezuela, but it's billions of dollars worth of oil and gas. And it's enough to supply Syria for generations and to sell and to have money to support a strong Syria and all of Syria's internal projects and development, as well as the Syrian Arab army in its fight. So I thought to myself, this is also a proxy war between the US and China, because if China had the exclusive rights to the oil fields that are now controlled by the Americans, and Trump went so far as, if you remember, last September, October, when the Turks were invading again with FSA, the Rojava, and everybody was crying and worried and this and that. And the Americans said, yeah, we're going to withdraw. And then they were going to, oh no, we're going to stay because of the oil. But the Americans don't need the oil. They don't want China, the Russians, and the Syrians to have the oil. Right? It's part of the geopolitics of this proxy war. So, you know,
it's just siege. It's what the Israelis are doing to Gaza too. It's you besiege them, absolutely, and you deny them rent of you. You clip off the things, and it's like a nice. It's and then you can also bribe. So you can dole out favors. So there's like a U.S. general who's in charge of the oil fields in Syria, and what's insane to me is that there are still people, respectable people who have brains, who still to this day are singing the praises of the quote Syrian revolution. As if you can't separate the U.S. balkanization and imperialist occupation of Syria, putting aside the Turkish one, right? And you can just sit and like, oh, okay, good, nice. You can just pick out the moderate rebels you support and say that's a good thing. And everybody else is bad. Therefore, anything else that... And then you can just withdraw. And that, to me, is the crime of so many pundits. A lot of brown ones, too. A lot of ones that are Arabs. A lot of... You know, people who are openly, who should know better, who in the name of like blue checkmark solidarity of some kind are just kind of saying, oh, it's fine to destroy this country. It's fine to wage a war on a state because I don't like the head of that state.
And not only that, but like, look at like your Molly Crabapples and, you know, your even your David Graebers and all this kind of stuff. You know, may he rest in peace. But he still was wrong about Rojava. He was wrong. Let me tell you one thing. There was no social
revolution. He was a disgusting regime changer. Yeah, he was a regime changer.
There was no
anarchy. There's an anarcho regime change movement in the US, and absolutely, their only interest in foreign policy is there's a neocon anarchist alliance. I mean, that is what's to say it out loud.
In fact, it's so bad. I'll tell you, it's so bad that the anarchists that I used to organize with call me an anti-Semite because I'm anti-Zionist, but they now use that as a term. They now would say that I am anti-Semitic, that I'm an Assadist, that I'm an apologist for war criminals gassing their people, that I betrayed my own people. And first and foremost, to that claim, I said...
And you're a Kurd! You're a Kurd! This is your part of the world! And these fucking people from fucking Arizona are lecturing you on your politics! I mean, it's insane! I just want to throw my desk at them and, like, get out of here.
I'm telling you.
Imperialist dogs.
Well, the first...
It's so fitting that the American left is so useless that they can't even get these easy layups right.
No,
that,
of course, like, not.
You recognize what imperialism is and you denounce it. Does that do anything? No. Does the American left have any kind of actual pull? No, absolutely not. But it's a car wash operation. And that's what Rojava ended up becoming. That's what the entire apparatus of these regime changers and all of the flunkies, the Western flunkies who have made careers out of it, that's what they've enabled, right? Congratulations. You helped Molly Krabappel get a Samsung artist award with her, thanks to, like, you know what I mean? Like they profit off it. You helped Brace Belden become a huge popular podcaster and make gobs of money every month, giving shitty takes and talking into a microphone. Like, congratulations. Like, all on the backs of dead Syrian kids and a destroyed, and like that one destroyed school, right? Oh, tough shit. There goes your school. You don't get to learn this year, kids. Like, and it's all just like an afterthought. Like, and on top of that, because they collapse the idea of the Syrian state with the head of that state, then anything is reasonable. Then they all turn into West Bappen, psycho, diseased mind imperialist. I mean, it's the strange Syria is the new, I believe this fully, Syria is the new litmus test for your politics. Palestine is out. Sorry, Palis. Sorry, Palis, it's all clear now. We all know the situation in Palestine. Al-Auda, end of the apartheid state. It's easy. That's the easy.
That's right. That's right.
But the real test of your mettle is, do you or do you not support the imperialist war on Syria and the various iterations of it, the extremely complicated web of relations? And the fact that you saw it up close more than anyone, and you know what's up, and like you can say that with confidence, that like, this is wrong. Like, what's happening here is wrong. I mean, that to me says something.
You know what? And you know what? I look back and I say, you know, was it right to fight against ISIS? Yeah, fuck them. Fuck them and fuck the horse they rode in on. But was it right that the Americans and the coalition went there and that the Kurds played a bad hand? And I'm not going to say all the Kurds. The leadership played a bad hand. Because what they did was they had this classic strategy where we're going to give Afrin to the Russians and we'll give the other two cantons, Kobani and Jazeera, to the Americans, and we'll play them off of each other and see who gives us more. Well, all in the meanwhile, maintaining lines of communication with Bashar al-Assad. But see, the Kurds got a smackdown because Russia didn't help in Afrin because the Americans put up a stink about it. And then Afrin was taken by Turkey. Now the Americans say that they're going to leave, and the Kurds have nothing but to go back to Assad and say, we're sorry, here it is. It's all yours again. They're going to have to do that. One way or another, northeast Syria, all of the areas controlled by the SDF will return to the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian state. That's a fact. I believe it. They will not be able to survive on their own. They can't. They can't. The only safeguard for the minorities in the northeast is the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian state. That's proven fact. Because Turkey will not listen to the Americans or anyone.
It's their state. They're professionals guarding their own state. That's their job. Like, who would you think defends Arkansas better? A guy from a guy from Malayer or a guy from Arkansas?
No,
but that's their state. It's theirs. It belongs to them. Like, let
absolutely
them defend it.
But you see, the longer the project exists, the more people say. But you know what the problem is? Here, let me tell you one thing that a lot of people don't talk about. Let's ask a question. What currency do they use in Northeast Syria and quote unquote Rojava, this anarchist, independent, you know, democratic confederalist, non-state entity? What currency do they use?
Dollars?
No, I wish. They do have dollars there. The Syrian currency. Assad's faces on them. God damn.
Yeah.
That's what
I mean, because that's the state. That was the state that they're a part of.
Like, and it's still the state.
Forge an anti-state and like use, like, it's insane, like the mental gymnastics, as you put it, like the that you have to do to logically defend an imperialist balkanization project. I mean, that's like, that's cuckoo bananas.
It is. And by the way, this is now the part of the podcast where we go to anarchists, what is it, anonymous anarchists, or we're recovering anarchists, you know. No, I'm telling you, the mental gymnastics were crazy. And if you looked at, like, basically, if you looked at interesting things like logistics, where did they get the weapons from? Where did this, it was all supplied by the coalition, or it was coming in still from the Syrian state, because the Syrian state was still getting supplies back and forth. I mean, the Syrian state still controlled the airport in Qamishli, in Qamishlo. Yeah, of course. Of course. And of course, The statue of Hafez al-Assad was still, you know, up. The Syrian flags were there. There were portraits and banners of Assad still in Hasaka, in Qamishlo, in other areas of the Northeast. So I think that, number one, eventually this war will be over. I hope. I really do. It's hopefully coming to an end. And I hope that Syria gets back every inch that it had. Every inch. Out with the Turks, with the Americans, with the coalition, and even with the PKK that have taken over. Go back and fight against Turkey. Continue the war against NATO. Good. Support it. But for me, the project, like you said, is not only a litmus test, but it reveals a lot about not only the ideologies behind the people who push it, but the much wider networks at play here. This is where I put my tinfoil hat on. I think the anarchist movement has been co-opted. I do.
Of course.
By some prominent people. I think it's been fully co-opted. I think it's totally bankrupt. And I think if you look at what you and I see online, on the Twitter, in the academy, and things like that, you quickly realize that there are some prominent voices who are suspect in terms of what their ulterior motives are. I honestly think that right now, a true anti-imperialist has the sole obligation to support the Syrian state and the Syrian people in the war. And that means supporting the central government. And by the way, Bashar al-Assad is the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. Whether you like it or not, it's what the Syrian people have decided. That's the way it is. The UN recognizes it that way. I'm sorry you don't like it. Too bad. Too bad. That's it. You know? There are Iranians who say, I don't like the Iranian government. Okay, too bad. If you're in America, shut the hell up. It's for the Iranians in Iran to decide. Not for you here living life of luxury and dreaming about mythical monarchist past, or, you know, projecting into the future a path for the MEK. Come on. Come on. You know, let's cut the shit. So for me, you know, I have since repented. I've done my penitence, all that stuff. So I think that, you know, being there and seeing it up close and personal, I'm very skeptical now of everything that goes on. Very skeptical. I'm more conspiratorial than I used to be. You know, especially now when we look at what's going on with China, what everybody's saying about Xinjiang. By the way, I've been to Xinjiang as well. So I saw that up close and personal, and
you've been to all the CIA hotspots. I'm just gonna say that.
I was before. Before it was a CIA hotspot.
I don't think so. You did like the CIA tour. You did China. You did the military. Then you did China. Oh, then you did the Middle East.
Oh god.
Like, I'm not calling you a spy, but. Bro, you have a spy.
Let me tell you one thing.
You have a spy CV.
They always joke. They always say the spies are redacted in the documents. Well, I'm unredacted, so that's quite a spy. No, for me, like when I was living in China for 2 years, I wanted to go to all of the areas. Don't forget, in China, there were also anarchists there. So I wanted to go see what was going on, you know, and I wanted to, you know, I was listening to some of these people too, you know, sort of the dissidents in China, what's going on, you know, what's happening in China. So I went to Outer Tibet, to Xinjiang. I traveled all over the country. I absolutely love China. I can't wait to go back. I have great relations with a lot of professors at the Chinese universities with their Marxist studies programs. So I went to Xinjiang, and of course, people were telling me, oh my God, the Uyghurs are repressed. By the way, while I was in China, there was a major terrorist attack in the railway stations of Kunming in Yunnan. So while I was there, I went to Xinjiang.
Not the Urumqi. That was 2010. No, that's sooner.
The Kunming attack was basically, there was a bunch of Uyghurs with knives, and they just stabbed a bunch of people in a train station. So that was a huge event in China in 2014. Major event. It prompted the state to do a lot of crackdowns on separatism and terrorism and this and that. So anyway, when I went to Xinjiang in 2015, yeah, of course there was a police presence. Of course there was a police presence. Were there issues? Yeah, of course. Where aren't there issues? Please spare me. Spare me the people with the blue check marks who talk about Xinjiang and the repression, quote unquote, that they're experiencing without talking about what's going on in the US. Yeah, of course. They talk more about China than they do about here, or what's going on in France, or what's going on in Germany. So I don't want to hear about it from them. But yeah, of course. Was life normal? Yeah, I went to mosques. People were praying, traditional clothing, traditional food, language. All of that was there. Signs that were bilingual or trilingual. Yeah, of course. It was there. I didn't see anything of what the Adrian Zenz, you know, puppet crowds are saying. You know, that this is somehow, you know, millions of people in camps. What millions of people are in camps? What millions of people are in camps?
That's the U.S. That's called the prison industrial complex.
Absolutely.
Man.
Absolutely. Like, a lot of projection.
It's such an insane projection.
It is.
It's just this, I mean, this idea that, and what's insane is that these anarchists, people who spend their entire lives, like vegans often, sorry, vegans, I don't mean to beat on you. There's no point beating on the vegans, but oftentimes, like the joke with vegans, unfair or not, is that they're very happy to tell you about it, right? And that's the same thing with anarchists. They're very excited to tell you of their radical politics. And yet, they can wholesale their entire institutions, like It's Going Down had a huge thing with Rojava. It still does Rojava, right? Like
absolutely.
Bellingcat guys, or Rojava freaks. Like that is Machiavellian kind of logic it's insane to do that and then do that in the name of we don't want free bread, we want the whole bakery. Excuse me? Like, that's your politics? You really not see the disconnect between your phrases and your actions? Like, this is the crazy thing.
I'll tell you one thing. This is where you know that I'm in good company. There's a website out there, there's like some like anarchist, you know, kind of shit websites. But there's this one that lists me, Aaron Mate, Max Blumenthal, Rania Khalek, a few people from PSL, other groups. And they say that not only were Assadists, genocide deniers, all this stuff, but it also lists as their primary sources for all their information and tells people to go see Bellingcat. I thought to myself, you couldn't have revealed yourself anymore. I mean, come on. At least you could have kept that secret and maintained some dignity. These people have no dignity. They just put it out there in the open, you know?
So it's insane. Like, they do it all in the name of hating Assad. There's like this weird obsession with this guy they've never met. It's never like, it's like this weird hyper fixation. You know what? It's almost, it's like, it reminds me of like the Israeli obsession with Iran. You know what I mean? Like, oh, or like, you know what I mean? Like that kind of like visceral, kind of insane, obsessive, kind of pinpointed humanization of everything that's wrong with the world. Pinpointed in one human being or one country. And that's what they do. And it's like, you know, your country does infinitely worse to its own prisoners than any Syrian government. Like, there is nothing bad that happens in Syria that doesn't happen 10 times more in the country that you live in, that you pay taxes to, that you are guilty of living in. And like, when you fight a revolution against that country, like, you would be killed by the state too, because that's what states do. They defend themselves. So like, this idea that people who are against the bloodshed in this country as if that we're somehow perpetuating this genocide. Shut the fuck up, man. Like, that's like the most enraging. And part of that too is related to Soleimani and the Iranian question. Because of the prominent role Soleimani had in organizing resistance and organizing the fight there, that's to these psychotic, deranged, carcinogenic Iranian regime changers, that's some kind of, oh, participating in the butchery of Syria. It's like, are you kidding me?
Get out of here.
Do you not see, like, if Iranians were doing that, why would people welcome them into the country? Why is there a huge swath of Syrian society that recognizes the work of these people who fought for their country? Because it was also fighting for their own country too. Like, this was an involved fight. Syria is our neighbor. Like, it is a Shia homeland. Like, that's not some sort of like far away place the way that it is here, right? It's not some imperialist venture. These are allies. And because we don't have allies, and I say this a lot on this podcast, we don't have allies. We just have our quislings and our proxies, and that's how we see the world, and we frame it that way. So, like, the projection of Syria is so crazy. Like, all the things that insane, depoliticized, extremely alienated, nice, nihilistic Americans projecting, and Brits too, projecting onto Syria, and the Kurds, and, like, people like you, people who, human beings, you know, like, all this kind of bullshit imperialist politics. You know, it's just, to me, like, one of the most horrendous things. And it's really like one of the inspirations for this podcast of mine. Like, it really was like, there is no place to go if you want some like rational, sane conversation around a place like Syria, because the nature of it is so like, just so like absurdly, it's like a policed, right? That any kind of statement that's even vaguely warm, vaguely respectful to the Syrian state is translated as some kind of apologia for fascism. And it's like, no, man, you're the one who's running interference for fascism. You're the one who says, oh, I support Syria revolution. And in so doing, you are supporting Turkish mercenaries. Like, those are your politics, not mine.
Absolutely. And also, one of the big things that people don't understand, like, the okay, here we get into another conversation I think is important. This whole red-brown alliance thing. I bought into it years ago. I bought into the idea that there was some sort of like red-brown Marxist-Leninist and like Nazbol fascist alliance. That's not true. That's not true. That's totally a concocted and fabricated story. Are there fascists who support things that MLs would support? Yeah, but for other reasons, not for the same reason. For example, let me go into some interesting tidbits about Rojava that a lot of people don't talk about. There were a lot of neo-Nazis who were there. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. Do you know why they went?
Why?
The Kurds are Aryans.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. You want to go on that route?
Oh,
I will take you down the wormhole of how complicated the mental
genetics. Have I just been Kurd-pilled?
Oh, yeah. Listen to this. So we were there and you know, I was training with some of the other internationals, and there was this one international from who was Dutch, from the Netherlands. And I started to realize that this guy definitely didn't have our politics. What you could describe them at that time, you know, as we've already alluded to and discussed. He had sort of a love of things that we normally wouldn't really associate with anything liberatory. And come to find out, he was a total Nazi, like totally in love with SS, in love with, all of these Nazi programs, totally thought that the Jewish bankers were controlling everything. And so when, you know, some of us called for his expulsion from there, you know what the Kurds said? Ah, classic. This is so classic. Said, no, he traveled all the way to fight for us. He's our guest. Of course, we're going to give him hospitality. And of course, he can fight for us. I said, wait, are you shitting me? That you're gonna pull that line? Like, you know, Abef Armat, you know, come on in. Come on in. What do you mean, come on in? Not only did he come and fight in Rojava, and was, by the way, he's considered a martyr because he died in Deir ez-Zor there. And he's listed on the YPG International site as a martyr. This neo-Nazi
has a website
that's totally fascist and has some Jewish guy as a spider over all of these people like zombies, and a guy who literally fought in Ukraine. Before he went to Rojava, we found out he fought in Ukraine with the Azov battalion.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. You want to know how much better it gets? In Shengal or Sinjar, in the northwest of Iraq where the Yazidis are, right? There were internationals also there with Yebeshe, which was basically the PKK's arm there, right? In Shengal, who else was there for the internationals? Phalanges.
They actually controlled
the international tabur, the international battalion there. Phalanges, Francois from Spain. So you can imagine the people from Catalonia and the people from Spain who were in the IFB and in other YPG organizations who considered themselves anarchists and anti-fascists, when they found out that the international grouping in Shengal next door was controlled by Phalanges, open crusader types who had crucifixes who had carved crucifixes on their Kalashnikovs to fight and kill Muslims. Oh, yeah. You want to talk about craziness? And when we went to the Kurdish leadership to have them expelled, they wouldn't expel them for the same reason. They had come to fight for the Kurdish liberation.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. When you make an alliance with the West, then you got to let in all the Yahoos and the kooks. I mean, that's it. So that's what it is. Like, this is the Pandora's box they opened.
Absolutely. And to be honest with you, it was some of these situations that also drove me crazy. It drove me crazy because I thought to myself, this is insane. There's no principles here. Where are the principles? None.
It's the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
I'm telling you. And so now I consider it total opportunism. The worst kind. I mean, it's like Mao shaking hands with Kissinger and Nixon and making an alliance with the Americans just to fuck the Soviets. Well, it ended up really destroying the whole communist movement worldwide. You know, it was all of these alliances of convenience and, all right, we're going to support this and that. Yeah, I'm sorry to all of the, you know, the people who somehow thought that Rojava was something beautiful and wonderful. No. Total opportunism, mix of reactionary ideologies. And by the way, the problem is when you leave ML, when the PKK left ML, and went to anarchism, it opened up Pandora's box for undisciplined ideological inquiry by some of its
teenagers.
Yeah, and
they let the teenagers into the club.
There were a lot of Kurdish nationalists who thought the same. Oh yeah, we're Aryan. Oh yeah, did you know that?
Boy. Oh yeah. Oh God. Oh, yeah. They got a bunch of like psycho libertarians come too with all their insane.
Oh yeah, they came too. We had libertarians.
I mean, this is what happens also too when you open up your struggle, when you align your struggle with an internet campaign and in digital virality, so to speak, like, or virality or whatever you want to call it, like that opens you up to all the freaks too of the internet, like all of the disgusting garbage of the internet is then opened up. So, wow.
I'll never forget we were in a class at the International Academy there, and there was about 20 of us in the class, and we were talking about who inspires us. And you know, people would say Che or Marx or this or that or Ocalan. And when this one kid from Texas got up, he said Hitler. I swear to God, I almost took out my pen and stabbed him in the fucking eye. But you know what the Kurdish leadership said? Oh no, he's just young. He's like 19. You know, he's learning. We're going to teach him. We're going to convert him. Wait, what? We're in the conversion process now? We're here to convert in the midst of a war that's tearing apart this entire country? I'm telling you, that conflict keeps me up at night with the mental not only the mental gymnastics, but the actual fucked upness that happened over there. The craziness that occurred over there. So when, for example, Ben Norton talks about this red-brown alliance sham that was pushed by the West, it's totally true. It's true because it denigrates now the principled positions of anti-imperialists who might find common ground on various topics with other people who don't share anything of their ideology, and we would fight with them too. Yeah. For example, you know about a lot of the conflict that goes on with SSNP, right? The Syrian Social Nationalist Party. Okay. We might disagree with you know, a lot of the positions of Saadat and all that stuff. And all that stuff that goes on with the formation of SSMP. But one thing cannot be disputed. When the question and the issue arose of Israel's invasion of Lebanon, SSMP allied with the Communist Party of Lebanon, allied with PFLP and all these different groups, and now finds itself allied with the Syrian government, with the Syrian resistance, with the two communist parties of Syria, all this stuff. So when people all of a sudden say, oh my God, you support Assad and he's supported by SSMP, which are like literal Nazis. Like, dude, no, please. Spare us, you know, all of this.
It's projection. It's projection. They're the Nazis. Oh, they're the Nazis.
I'm telling you, when they're supporting in Ukraine, the Azov battalion.
Regime changers are Nazis, man. They are Richard Pearl. They are fucking Donald Rumsfeld. They are evil, man. They are insane blood cycle. Because underneath, scratch the heart of any, like underneath the idea of regime change, even if it's in the name of this random group of darkies that I endorse because I like them and their online presence is the most convincing to me. Like, even then, underneath that is the reason why I support them is because they're like me, because they believe in what I do. And so there's a chauvinism underneath that.
Absolutely.
Even forget the fact that it took chauvinism to get them there, to even think about this issue. That, like, underneath the idea that you can regime change a country better, is the idea that they not only need it, but that it's possible. Right. And like that is the racism. That is the profound Orientalist mind. And the fact that they've gotten so many Arabs and Iranians and people who should know better, who lived through regime change, they've gotten them to sign on to this project through the overthrow of the dictator Assad. Right. It's just like, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of things to be said. But bro, we've been talking for 2 hours.
Oh my God. One last thing. Oh my God. There's so much to talk about.
I have to make this into several episodes.
Okay. Hold on. Listen to this. So for the Tulsi stands out there, if any of your listeners were sympathetic to Tulsi Gabbard, I'm about to nuke you. So Tulsi Gabbard came up here to discuss, you know, during her campaign, she came up to New Hampshire, to Dartmouth, where I'm a graduate student. So she came up to Dartmouth to give a speech about, you know, her campaign. So I went, of course. You know, I was interested in Tulsi. She had all this anti-war, anti-imperialist supposed positions, whatever. Okay, nice. And they also tried to Russiagate her as well and this. And she's a Putin puppet, whatever. It was one question that demolished her in my mind. So I said, I appreciate what you said about, you know, not arming jihadists in Syria, all that stuff. That's all very good and well. But can you tell me, why does the U.S. arm the Azov Battalion and, you know, the right sector and all of these different neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine fighting for NATO in a proxy war against, you know, separatists in Donbass, in Donetsk and Lugansk, who are fighting to not be under a Nazi regime, basically, to not be under a fascist sympathetic regime that holds up the banner of Stepan Bandera. You know what she said? She said, no, I absolutely support Ukrainian aid. I support aid to Ukraine. I thought to myself, okay, there goes any sort of, you know, support for Tulsi saying that she's an anti-this, anti-war, whatever, regime change. Fuck that. Not true.
You can't be in the U.S. They'll JFK you.
Of course they will.
They're not. Every single politician is under the thumb of the military industrial complex to one degree or another.
It's
now,
true.
Is every single one of them going to launch a regime change war? No, but they go along with it. And
they
that's
do.
The point.
They do.
That's the point.
And so for me, you know, ultimately, my experiences in Syria were not only transformative, but they really opened my eyes to see how easy it is to co-opt a total movement and to create a narrative and for the media to project this, you know, balkanization and project, imperial project, really an imperial protectorate, to project it as women's liberation, democratic confederalism, anarchist utopia, Spanish Civil War, Kobani as Stalingrad, all this stuff. And you realize that so many people were pilled into that. So many people bought into it, even when people like me came out and said, well, it's not exactly that way. I'm still on the left. Absolutely. I've never left the left. I never have. Have I made mistakes? Sure, of course. Joining the military wasn't the best thing. Yes, true. But at the same time, now I'm more principled than ever through the experiences. And then, of course, when we speak, what do we get? Assadist, this, that. I'm a she puppet. I'm a Putin puppet. I think to myself, these people have no arguments. That's the thing. They cannot deal with reality. So they have to create boogeymen or boogie women to then instill on us and say that somehow we're the ones who are messed up or we have ulterior motives. Listen, everybody out there, I live on a farm. I have no ulterior motives. I enjoy the farm. I just want to hang out on the farm. Love the animals. I hate academia now. F all these people. You know, I mean, I swear to God, I'm so sick of it. I'm happy here with a desk full of books and our kids and just hanging out and enjoying life here. But I mean, seriously, I have
no. Does Syria haunt you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I'm in talks right now. I'm hoping to go on a delegation to Damascus, and I would love to shake the hand of President Assad and apologize for what I did, and to say that I support the Syrian state, and I want to continue to support the Syria's self-determination, Syria's independence, Syria's territorial integrity, and of course, I'm talking to a lot of activists who are trying to make that possible. We've had contact with the two Syrian communist parties. I've made amends. I've tried to make amends and say, you know, and of course, even people have said, yes, your fight against ISIS was good, but that project shouldn't be supported. I say, yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I agree.
But does the war itself haunt you? Like just the things you saw, the good old fashioned, American for PTSD?
Sure. For sure. For sure. I mean, none of that stuff. War will stay with you. I mean, there are times when I'll hear like a gunshot or things like that. Instantly, you know, I flinch and jump down. You know, it's just within you now. You know, you cannot ever let it go. And even to see death. It's hard. For example, we just slaughtered two pigs and I had to shoot them. And instantly in that moment, I had a flashback. You know, it's like I can't do a normal thing.
What did you flash back to?
I flashed back to all the firefights that we had and to seeing death. Like, there I was, you know, with an animal.
Was there one specific one?
The specific one was entering that village and seeing all the burnt and dismembered bodies. I mean, that's the image that stays with me the most. It's the image that keeps me up at night, you know? Because I don't know if these people were really diehard, you know? They just, like, basically bombed this school and destroyed this village. Maybe this kid would have said, you know, if we came in there, put down the gun and said, look, I don't want to deal with this. You know, I just got paid and they forced me to and I didn't want anything to do with this. The Americans didn't care about that. They didn't give a shit. Bomb everything back to the Stone Age. You know, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, they're all making a killing. So fuck it. Let's keep the profits rolling. And it haunts me. Of course it haunts me. It haunts me that, you know, a guerrilla army would have conducted the war differently. A principled guerrilla army would have conducted the war differently. They would have rather taken heavy casualties than to inflict civilian harm, because ultimately a guerrilla army is a people's army that wants the support of the people to carry out its revolutionary goals. This wasn't that way. No, this had the veneer of that. But the deeper, when you get in deep, the deeper core was an imperial project, like you were saying. That's it. That's it. And that's what there needs to be a reckoning. There needs to be a reckoning on the left that this was an imperial project and we have to deal with it. And people who supported it, I'm not going to say that, oh my God, you supported it. And if you change position, somehow you're still suspect. No, I accept people who change. We are only human. People change and adapt. There are people who came to the left from the right. There are people who moved from the right to the left, which is the worst. Oh my God. I mean, there are people out there who do that too. But people who switch their positions from supporting Rojava or other projects to then supporting the Syrian state and the Syrian people, my hat's off to them, because instantly they get called all sorts of names. Their names get dragged through the mud. They don't get published. They get, you know, they get sort of pushed out of academia. It happened to me. I'm totally ostracized where I'm at. Totally. Even amongst the activist community, I'm totally ostracized. Because I have quote-unquote unorthodox positions, which for me are pretty orthodox, but for, you know, anarchists or social democrats or DSA types and all this stuff, they're totally not acceptable. So I get pushed to the fringes, and then everybody can easily dismiss me as a conspiracy theorist, a wingnut, tinfoil hat wearer, this and that. I mean, I'm fine with that. I'm here. I'm not. I don't need any, you know, recognition of that. But I will just.
Who needs their solidarity with solidarity like that? Who wants to be around them?
I don't want to be associated with them at all.
There is no American left. There is a center, and then everything else is right wing, and from that center is the baseline is support core imperial projects. Even though it's bad thing to do that, so dress it up, add a veneer of democratic revolution, and everybody wins.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, to be honest with you, right now, there is no left in the U.S. I support, you know, all of the great journalists, like we mentioned before, some of the name, Max Blumenthal, you know, Ben Norton, Rania Halleck, all the people at the Gray Zone, Aaron Mate, the journalists like Seymour Hersh and all of these people who opened the eyes of so many. But people even like Chomsky, who I interviewed back in 2013, they're totally bankrupt on a lot of these issues. Totally. Totally. You know, some things good, some things bad. But a lot of them have been pilled by Rojava into thinking that it's somehow some sort of liberatory project. And that's just not true. It's not true at all. And even the people, go talk to the people there. They'll also have a bunch of gripes and issues. So I think ultimately our main thing, and I think the beauty of this podcast, is to really open people's eyes to a principled anti-imperialist position. It doesn't mean you have to support everything that goes on in these states. Yeah, were there neoliberal reforms in the Syrian state before the civil war? Yeah. Do I support them? No. But that's for the Syrian people to decide. And eventually now they end up coming back and saying, yeah, we're not going to do those reforms anymore. We're still going to have state ownership and control. Ultimately for them to decide. Does that mean that we're going to go in there and start carpet bombing everybody and telling them that, oh yeah, we don't like your reforms, so we're going to put in our... No, of course not. We have to still be principled out there. And there's less and less principled anti-imperialists out there. It's a real tragedy. But I'll take being called an Assadist and a Putin apologist or a Xi puppet or a Maduro lackey any day before I get called a puppet or a lackey of U.S. NATO imperialism. That's my thing. So, you know, they can continue to slander me all they want, but I know what I saw. I know what I experienced. And I'm here just to continue the fight and to continue the fight with you and so many others to uphold a principled line and to really open people's eyes to what's going on and what's behind the scenes.
Thank you, sir. That was a crazy, crazy conversation. How do people find you? You have something you want to announce? Project? Well, are you ready to announce it?
Yeah, sure. I've been working with some of my comrades in starting a podcast. Not necessarily for money, I could care less about that, but really just to get some interesting voices out there from the ML movement and people with different experiences. So it's going to be called Not One Step Back, from the famous order given by Comrade Stalin to the front during World War II. And that'll be coming out hopefully in the winter, early spring of 2021. So please keep an eye out for that. And you can follow me at Chris Halali. That's Chris and last name Halali, or www.christopherhalali.com. And I'm always open. Email me questions, DM me. I like to respond to everybody. I might not respond immediately because, you know, family, farm, work, life, all that craziness. But please reach out. Reach out. I even accept hate mail. I might not necessarily respond, but I look forward to continuing to build a strong anti-imperialist movement and to working with you and with everybody out there to hopefully rebuild a really strong, principled American left, if it's possible. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, man.